His mouth compress, and his eyes glisten. He looked away at the window and then back at me. I didn't know whether he would have preferred it if I'd looked away.
Third bout in 2 years.
It took me a minute to catch up. Of pneumonia?
He nodded. Wretched thing. He's pretty brave, you know, under all that bluster.
He swallowed and nodded, as if to himself.
It's good you can see it, Louisa.
I didn't know what to do. I reached out my hand and touched his arm. I do see it. He gave me a faint nod, then took his Panama hat from the coat hooks in the hall. Muttering something that might have been a thank you or a goodbye, Mr. Trainer moved past me and out the front door. The annex felt oddly silent without Will in it. I realized how much I'd become used to the distant sound of his motorized chair moving backward and forward, his murmured conversations with Nathan in the next room, the low hum of the radio. Now the annex was still, the air like a vacuum around me. I packed an overnight bag with all the things he might want the next day, including clean clothes, his toothbrush, hairbrush, and medication, plus earphones in case he was well enough to listen to music. As I did so, I had to fight a peculiar sense of panic. A subversive little voice kept rising up inside me, saying, "This is how it would feel if he were dead." To drown it out, I turned on the radio, trying to bring the annex back to life. I did some cleaning, made Will's bed with fresh sheets, and picked some flowers from the garden, which I put in the living room. And then, when I'd gotten everything ready, I glanced over and saw the holiday folder on the table. I would spend the following day going through all the paperwork and cancelling every trip, every excursion I had booked. There was no saying when Will would be well enough to do any of them. The consultant had stressed that he had to rest, to complete his course of antibiotics, to stay warm and dry. Whitewater rafting and scuba diving were not part of his plan for convalescence. I stared at my folder, at all the effort and work and imagination that had gone into compiling it. I stared at the passport that I'd queued to collect, remembering my mounting sense of excitement even as I sat on the train heading into the city. And for the first time since I'd embarked upon my plan, I felt properly despondent. There were just over 3 weeks to go, and I had failed. My contract was due to end, and I had done nothing to noticeably change Will's mind. I was afraid to even ask Mrs. Trainer where on earth we went from here. I felt suddenly overwhelmed. I dropped my head into my hands, and in the silent little house, I left it there.
Evening.
My head shot up. Nathan was standing there, filling the little kitchen with his bulk. He had his backpack over his shoulder.
I just came to drop off some prescription meds for when he gets back. You okay?
I wiped briskly at my eyes. Sure. Sorry. Just a little daunted about cancelling this lot. Nathan swung his backpack off his shoulder and sat down opposite me.
It's a pisser, that's for sure.
He picked up the folder and began flipping through.
You want a hand tomorrow? They don't want me at the hospital, so I could stop by for an hour in the morning, help you put in the calls.
That's kind of you, but no, I'll be fine. Probably simpler if I do it all. Nathan made tea and we sat opposite each other and drank it. I think it was the first time Nathan and I had really talked to each other, at least without Will between us. He told me about a previous client of his, C3-4 quadriplegic with a ventilator, who'd been ill at least once a month for the whole time he worked there. He told me about Will's previous bouts of pneumonia, the first of which had nearly killed him, and from which it had taken him weeks to recover.
"He gets this look in his eye," he said, "when he's really sick. It's pretty scary. Like he just retreats. Like he's almost not even there."
"I know. I hate that look."
"He's a..."
he began. And then, abruptly, his eyes slid away from me, and he closed his mouth. We sat holding our mugs. From the corner of my eye, I studied Nathan, looking at his friendly, open face that seemed briefly to have closed off. And I realized I was about to ask a question to which I already knew the answer. "You know, don't you?"
"Know what?"
"About what he wants to do." The silence in the room was sudden and intense. Nathan looked at me carefully, as if weighing how to reply. "I know," I said. "I'm not meant to, but I do. That's what the holiday was meant to be about. That's what the outings were all about. Me trying to change his mind." Nathan put his mug on the table.
"I did wonder," he said. "You seemed to be on a mission."
"I was. Am." He shook his head. Whether to say I shouldn't give up, or to tell me that nothing could be done, I wasn't sure. "What are we going to do, Nathan?" It took him a moment or two before he spoke again. "You know what, Lou?
I really like Will. I don't mind telling you, I love the guy. I've been with him 2 years now. I've seen him at his worst, and I've seen him on his good days. And all I can say to you is I wouldn't be in his shoes for all the money in the world."
He took a swig of his tea.
"There have been times when I've stayed over and he's woken up screaming, because in his dreams he's still walking and skiing and doing stuff, and just for those few minutes, when his defenses are down and it's all a bit raw, he literally can't bear the thought of never doing it again. He can't bear it. I've sat there with him, and there is nothing I can say to the guy. Nothing that's going to make it any better. He's been dealt the shittiest hand of cards you can imagine. And you know what? I looked at him last night, and I thought about his life and what it's likely to become. And although there is nothing I'd like more in the world than for the big guy to be happy, I can't judge him for what he wants to do. It's his choice. It should be his choice."
My breath had started to catch in my throat. "But that was before. You've all admitted that it was before I came. He's different now. He's different with me, right?"
"Sure, but..."
"But if we don't have faith that he can feel better, even get better, then how's he supposed to keep the faith that good things might happen?" Nathan put his mug on the table. He looked straight into my eyes.
"Lou, he's not going to get better."
"You don't know that."
"I do. Unless there's some massive breakthrough in stem cell research, Will is looking at another decade in that chair, minimum. He knows it, even if his folks don't want to admit it. And this is half of the trouble. She wants to keep him alive at any cost. Mr. T thinks there's a point where we have to let him decide."
"Of course he gets to decide, Nathan. But he has to see what his actual choices are."
He's a bright guy. He knows exactly what his choices are. My voice lifted in the little room. No, you're wrong. You tell me he was in the same place before I came. You tell me he hasn't changed his outlook even a little bit just through me being here. I can't see inside his head, Lou. You know I've changed the way he thinks. No. I know that he'll do pretty much anything to make you happy. I stared at him. You think he's going through the motions just to keep me happy? I felt furious with Nathan, furious with them all. So if you don't believe any of this can do any good, why were you going to come at all? Why did you even want to come on this trip? Just a nice holiday, was it? No, I want him to live. But I want him to live if he wants to live. If he doesn't, then by forcing him to carry on, you, me, no matter how much we love him, we become just another shitty bunch of people taking away his choices. Nathan's words reverberated into the silence. I wiped a solitary tear from my cheek and tried to make my heart rate return to normal. Nathan, apparently embarrassed by my tears, scratched absently at his neck, and then, after a minute, silently handed me a paper towel. I can't just let it happen, Nathan. He said nothing. I can't. I stared at my passport, sitting on the kitchen table. It was a terrible picture. It looked like someone else entirely. Someone whose life, whose way of being, might actually be nothing like my own. I stared at it, thinking. Nathan.
What?
If I could fix some other kind of trip, something the doctors would agree to, would you still come? Would you still help me?
Of course I would.
He stood, rinsed his mug and hauled his backpack over his shoulder. He turned to face me before he left the kitchen.
But I've got to be honest, Lou. I'm not sure even you're going to be able to pull this one off.
Chapter 23. Exactly 10 days later, Will's father disgorged us from the car at Gatwick Airport, Nathan wrestling our luggage onto a trolley, and me checking and checking again that Will was comfortable, until even he became irritated.
"Take care of yourselves, and have a good trip," Mr. Traynor said, placing a hand on Will's shoulder. "Don't get up to too much mischief."
He actually winked at me when he said this.
Mrs. Traynor hadn't been able to leave work to come too. I suspected that actually meant she hadn't wanted to spend 2 hours in a car with her husband. Will nodded, but said nothing. He'd been disarmingly quiet in the car, gazing out the window with his impenetrable stare, ignoring Nathan and me as we chatted about traffic and what we already knew we had forgotten. Even as we walked across the concourse, I wasn't sure we were doing the right thing. Mrs. Traynor hadn't wanted him to go at all. But from the day he agreed to my revised plan, I knew she'd been afraid to tell him he shouldn't. She seemed to be afraid of talking to us at all that last week. She sat with Will in silence, talking only to the medical professionals, or busied herself in her garden, cutting things down with frightening efficiency. "The airline's meant to meet us. They're meant to come and meet us," I said, as we made our way to the check-in desk, flipping through my paperwork.
"Chill out. They're hardly going to post someone at the doors," Nathan said.
"But the chair has to travel as a fragile medical device. I checked with the woman on the phone 3 times, and we need to make sure they're not going to get funny about Will's onboard medical equipment." The online quad community had given me reams of information, warnings, legal rights and checklists. I had subsequently triple-checked with the airline that we would be given bulkhead seats and that Will would be boarded first and not moved from his power chair until we were actually at the gate.
Nathan would remain on the ground, remove the joystick and turn it to manual, and then carefully tie and bolster the chair, securing the pedals. He would personally oversee its loading to protect against damage. It would be pink-tagged to warn luggage handlers of its extreme delicacy. We'd been allocated 3 seats in a row so that Nathan could complete any medical assistance that Will needed without prying eyes. The airline had assured me that the armrests lifted so that we wouldn't bruise Will's hips while transferring him from the wheelchair to his aircraft seat. We would keep him between us at all times, and we would be the first allowed off the aircraft. All this was on my airport checklist. That was the sheet in front of my hotel checklist, but behind my day-before-we-leave checklist and the itinerary. Even with all these safeguards in place, I felt sick. Every time I looked at Will, I wondered if I'd done the right thing. He'd been cleared by his GP for travel only the night before. He ate little and spent much of every day asleep. He seemed not just weary from his illness, but exhausted with life, tired of our interference, our upbeat attempts at conversation, our relentless determination to try to make things better for him. He tolerated me, but I got the feeling that he often wanted to be left alone. He didn't know that this was the one thing I could not do. "There's the airline woman," I said, as a uniformed girl with a bright smile and a clipboard walked briskly toward us.
"Well, she's going to be a lot of use on transfer," Nathan muttered. "She doesn't look like she could lift a frozen prawn."
"We'll manage," I said. "Between us, we will manage." It had become my catchphrase ever since I'd worked out what I wanted to do. Since my conversation with Nathan in the annex, I'd been filled with a renewed zeal to prove them all wrong. Just because we couldn't do the holiday I'd planned didn't mean that Will couldn't do anything at all. I hit the message boards, firing out questions. Where might be a good place for a far weaker Will to convalesce? Did anyone else know where we could go? Temperature was my main consideration. The English climate was too changeable. There was nothing more depressing than an English seaside resort in the rain. Much of Europe was too hot in late July, ruling out Italy, Greece, the south of France, and other coastal areas. I had a vision, you see. I saw Will relaxing by the sea. The problem was, with only a few days to plan it and go, there was a diminishing chance of making it a reality. There were commiserations from the others, and many, many stories about pneumonia. It seemed to be the spectre that haunted them all. There were a few suggestions as to places we could go, but none that inspired me. Or, more important, none that I felt Will would be inspired by. I didn't really know what I wanted, but I scrolled backward through the list of their suggestions and knew that nothing was right. It was Richie, that chat room stalwart who'd come to my aid in the end. The afternoon that Will was released from hospital, he typed, "Give me your email address. Cousin is travel agent. I've got him on the case." I had rung the number he gave me and spoken to a middle-aged man with a broad Yorkshire accent. When he told me what he had in mind, a little bell of recognition rang somewhere deep in my memory. And within 2 hours we had it sorted. I was so grateful to him that I could have cried.
"Think nothing of it, pet," he said. "You just make sure that bloke of yours has a good time."
That said, by the time we left, I was almost as exhausted as Will was. I'd spent days wrangling with the finer requirements of quadriplegic travel, and right up until the morning we left, I hadn't been convinced that Will would be well enough to come. Now, seated with the bags, I gazed at him, withdrawn and pale in the bustling airport, and wondered again if I'd been wrong. I had a sudden moment of panic. What if he got ill again? What if he hated every minute, as he had with the horse racing? What if I had misread this whole situation, and what Will needed was not an epic journey, but 10 days at home in his own bed?
but we didn't have 10 days to spare. This was it. This was my only chance.
They're calling our flight, Nathan said, as he strolled back from the duty-free. He looked at me, raised an eyebrow, and I took a breath.
Okay, I replied. Let's go.
The flight itself, despite 12 long hours in the air, was not the ordeal I'd feared. Nathan proved himself dexterous at doing Will's routine changes under cover of a blanket. The airline staff was solicitous and discreet and careful with the chair. Will was, as promised, loaded first, achieved transfer to his seat with no bruising, and then settled in between us. Within an hour of being in the air, I realized that, oddly enough, above the clouds, provided his seat was tilted and he was wedged in enough to be stable, Will was pretty much equal to anyone in the cabin. Stuck in front of a screen with nowhere to move and nothing to do, there was very little at 30,000 feet up that separated him from any of the other passengers. He ate and watched a film, and mostly he slept. Nathan and I smiled cautiously at each other and tried to behave as if this were fine, all good. I gazed out the window, my thoughts as jumbled as the clouds beneath us, unable yet to think about the fact that this was not just a logistical challenge, but an adventure for me. That I, Lou Clark, was actually headed to the other side of the world. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see anything beyond Will by then. I felt like my sister when she'd first given birth to Thomas. "It's like I'm looking through a funnel," she had said, gazing at his newborn form. "The world has just shrunk to me and him." She had texted me when I was in the airport. "You can do this. I'm bloody proud of you, XXX. I called it up now, just to look at it, feeling suddenly emotional, perhaps because of her choice of words, or perhaps because I was tired and afraid, and still finding it hard to believe that I'd even gotten us this far. Finally, to block my thoughts, I turned on my little television screen, gazing unseeing at some American comedy series until the skies around us grew dark. And then I woke to find that the flight attendant was standing over us with breakfast, that Will was talking to Nathan about a film they'd just watched together, and that, astonishingly, and against all the odds, the three of us were less than an hour away from landing in Mauritius. I don't think I believed that any of this could actually happen, until we touched down at Sisiu Saga Rangulam International Airport. We emerged groggily through arrivals, still stiff from our time in the air, and I could have wept with relief at the sight of the operator's specially adapted taxi. That first morning, as the drivers sped us toward the resort, I registered little of the island. True, the colours seemed brighter than in England, the sky more vivid, an azure blue that just disappeared and grew deeper and deeper to infinity. I saw that the island was lush and green, fringed with acres of sugarcane crops, the sea visible like a strip of mercury through the volcanic hills. The air was tinged with something smoky and gingery, the sun so high in the sky that I had to squint into the white light. In my exhausted state, it was as if someone had woken me up in the pages of a glossy magazine. But even as my senses wrestled with the unfamiliar, my gaze returned repeatedly to Will, to his pale, weary face, to the way his head seemed oddly slumped on his shoulders. And then we pulled into a palm tree-lined driveway, stopped outside a low-framed building, and the driver was already out and unloading our bags. We declined the offer of iced tea, of a tour around the hotel. We found Will's room, dumped his bags, settled him into his bed, and almost before we had drawn the curtains, he was asleep again. And then there we were. I had done it. I stood outside his room, finally letting out a deep breath, while Nathan gazed out the window at the white surf on the coral reef beyond. I don't know if it was the journey, or because this was the most beautiful place I'd ever been in my life, but I felt suddenly tearful.
"That's okay," Nathan said, catching sight of my expression.
And then, totally unexpectedly, he walked up to me and enveloped me in a huge bear hug.
"Relax, Lou. It's going to be okay. Really. You did good."
It was almost 3 days before I started to believe him. Will slept for most of the first 48 hours. And then, astonishingly, he began to look better. His skin regained its color, and he lost the blue shadows around his eyes. His spasms lessened, and he began to eat again, wheeling his way slowly along the endless, extravagant buffet and telling me what he wanted on his plate. I knew he was feeling more like himself when he bullied me into trying things I would never have eaten, spicy Creole curries and seafood whose names I didn't recognize. He swiftly seemed more at home in this place than I did. And no wonder. I had to remind myself that for most of his life, this had been Will's domain. This globe, these wide shores, not the little annex in the shadow of the castle. The hotel had, as promised, come up with a special wheelchair with wide wheels, and most mornings Nathan transferred Will into it, and we all three walked down to the beach, me carrying a parasol so that I could protect him if the sun grew too fierce. But it never did. That southern part of the island was renowned for sea breezes, and out of season the resort temperatures rarely rose past 75 degrees Fahrenheit. We would stop at a small beach near a rocky outcrop, just out of view of the main hotel. I would unfold my chair, place myself next to Will under a palm tree, and we would watch Nathan attempt to windsurf or water ski, occasionally shouting encouragement, plus the odd word of abuse, from our spot on the sand. At first, the hotel staff wanted to do almost too much for Will, offering to push his chair, constantly pressing cool drinks upon him. We explained what we didn't need from them, and they cheerfully backed off. It was good, though, during the moments when I wasn't with him, to see porters or reception staff stopping by to chat with him, or sharing with him some place that they thought we should go. There was one gangly young man, Nadil, who seemed to take it upon himself to act as Will's unofficial caregiver when Nathan wasn't around. One day I came out to find him and a friend gently lowering Will out of his chair onto a cushioned sunbed he'd positioned by our tree. "This better," he said, giving me a thumbs up as I walked across the sand. "You just call me when Mr. Will wants to go back in his chair." I was about to protest and tell them they shouldn't have moved him, but Will had closed his eyes and lay there with a look of such unexpected contentment that I just closed my mouth and nodded. As for me, as my anxiety about Will's health began to ebb, I slowly began to suspect that I was actually in paradise. I had never in my life imagined I would spend time somewhere like this. Every morning I woke to the sound of the sea breaking gently on the shore, unfamiliar birds calling to one another from the trees. I gazed up at my ceiling, watching the sunlight playing through the leaves, and from next door heard the murmured conversation that told me Will and Nathan had already been up long before me. I dressed in sarongs and swimsuits, enjoying the feeling of the warm sun on my shoulders and back. My skin grew freckled, my nails bleached, and I began to feel a rare happiness at the simple pleasures of existing here, of walking on a beach, eating unfamiliar foods, swimming in warm, clear water where black fish gazed shyly from under volcanic rocks, or watching the sun sink fiery red into the horizon. Slowly, the past few months began to slip away. To my shame, I hardly thought of Patrick at all. Our days fell into a pattern. We ate breakfast together, all three of us, at the gently shaded tables around the pool. Will usually had fruit salad, which I fed to him by hand, and sometimes followed up with a banana pancake as his appetite grew. We then went down to the beach, where we stayed, me reading, Will listening to music, while Nathan practiced his water sport skills. Will kept telling me to try something too, but at first I said no. I just wanted to stay next to him. When Will insisted, I spent one morning windsurfing and kayaking, but I was happiest just hanging out next to him. Occasionally, if Nadil was around and the resort was quiet, he and Nathan would ease Will into the warm water of the smaller pool, Nathan holding him under his head so that he could float. He didn't say much when they did this, but he looked quietly contented, as if his body were remembering long-forgotten sensations. His torso, long pale, grew golden. His scars silvered and began to fade. He grew comfortable without a shirt. At lunchtime, we would wheel our way over to one of the resort's three restaurants. The surface of the whole complex was tiled, with only a few small steps and slopes, which meant that Will could move in his chair with complete autonomy. It was a small thing, but his being able to get himself a drink without one of us accompanying him meant not so much a rest for me and Nathan, as the brief removal of one of Will's daily frustrations, being entirely dependent on other people. Not that any of us had to move much anywhere. It seemed wherever you were, beach or poolside, or even the spa, one of the smiling staff would pop up with some drink they thought you might like, usually decorated with a fragrant pink flower. Even as you lay on the beach, a small buggy would pass, and a smiling waiter would offer you water, fruit juice, or something stronger. In the afternoons, when the temperatures were at their highest, Will would return to his room and sleep for a couple of hours. I would swim in the pool or read my book, and then in the evening we would all meet again to eat supper at the beachside restaurant. I swiftly developed a taste for cocktails. Nadil had worked out that if he gave Will the correct size straw and placed a tall glass in his holder, Nathan and I needn't be involved at all. As dusk fell, the three of us talked of our childhoods and our first significant others and our first jobs and our families and other holidays we'd had. And slowly, I saw Will reemerge. Except this Will was different. This place seemed to have granted him a peace that had been missing the whole time I had known him.
"He's doing good, huh?"
said Nathan, as he met me by the buffet. "Yes, I think he is."
"You know,"
Nathan leaned toward me, reluctant for Will to see we were talking about him.
"I think the ranch thing and all the adventures would have been great. But looking at him now, I can't help thinking this place has worked out better."
I didn't tell him what I'd decided on the first day when we checked in, my stomach knotted with anxiety, already calculating how many days I had until the return home. I had to try for each of those 10 days to forget why we were actually there. The 6-month contract, my carefully plotted calendar, everything that had come before. I had to just live in the moment and try to encourage Will to do the same. I had to be happy, in the hope that Will would be too. I helped myself to another slice of melon and smiled. "So, what's on later? Are we doing the karaoke? Or have your ears not yet recovered from last night?" On the fourth night, Nathan announced with only faint embarrassment that he had a date. Karen was a fellow Kiwi staying in the next hotel, and he'd agreed to go down to the town with her.
"Just to make sure she's all right. You know, I'm not sure if it's a good place for her to go alone."
"No," Will said, nodding his head sagely.
"Very chivalrous of you, Nate."
"I think that's a very responsible thing to do. Very civic-minded," I agreed.
"I've always admired Nathan for his selflessness,
especially when it comes to the fairer sex."
"Puss off, you two."
Nathan grinned and disappeared. Karen swiftly became a fixture, Nathan disappeared with her most evenings, and although he returned for late duties, we tacitly gave him as much time as possible to enjoy himself. Besides, I was secretly glad. I liked Nathan, and I was grateful that he'd come, but I preferred it when it was just Will and me. I liked the shorthand we seemed to fall into when nobody else was around, the easy intimacy that had sprung up between us. I liked the way he turned his face and looked at me with amusement, like I had somehow turned out to be so much more than he'd expected. On the penultimate night, I told Nathan that I didn't mind if he wanted to bring Karen back to the complex. He'd been spending nights in her hotel, and I knew it made it difficult for him, walking the 20 minutes each way in order to sort Will out last thing at night. I don't mind, if it'll, you know, give you a bit of privacy. He was cheerful, already lost in the prospect of the night ahead, and didn't give me another thought beyond an enthusiastic, "Thanks, mate."
"Nice of you," said Will when I told him.
"Nice of you, you mean," I said. "It's your room I've donated to the cause." That night we got him into mine, and Nathan helped Will into bed and gave him his medication, while Karen waited next door. In the bathroom I changed into my T-shirt and knickers, and then opened the bathroom door and potted over to the sofa with my pillow under my arm. I felt Will's eyes on me, and felt oddly self-conscious for someone who'd spent most of the previous week walking around in front of him in a bikini. I plumped my pillow down on the sofa arm.
"Clark?"
"What?"
"You really don't have to sleep over there. This bed's large enough for an entire football team as it is."
The thing is, I didn't really even think about it. That was how it was by then. Perhaps the days spent near naked on the beach had loosened us all up a little. Perhaps it was the thought of Nathan and Karen on the other side of the wall, wrapped up in each other, a cocoon of exclusion. Perhaps I did just want to be near him. I began to walk toward the bed, then flinched at a sudden crash of thunder. The lights stuttered. Someone shouted outside. From next door we heard Nathan and Karen burst out laughing. I walked to the window and pulled back the curtain, feeling the sudden breeze, the abrupt drop in temperature. Out at sea, a storm had exploded into life. Dramatic flashes of forked lightning briefly illuminated the sky, and then, as if in afterthought, the heavy drumbeat roll of a deluge hit the roof of our little bungalow, so fierce that at first it drowned out sound. "I'd better close the shutters," I said.
"No, don't."
I turned.
"Throw the doors open."
Will nodded toward the outside.
"I want to see it."
I hesitated, then slowly opened the glass doors out onto the terrace. The rain hammered down on the hotel complex, dripping from our roof, sending rivers running away from our terrace and out toward the sea. I felt the moisture on my face, the electricity in the air. The hairs on my arms stood bolt upright.
"Can you feel it?" he said, from behind me.
"It's like the end of the world." I stood there, letting the charge flow through me, the white flashes imprinting themselves on my eyelids. It caused my breath to catch in my throat. I turned back and walked over to the bed, seating myself on its edge. As he watched, I leaned forward and gently pulled his sun-brown neck toward me. I knew just how to move him now. How I could make his weight, his solidity, work with me. Holding him close to me, I leaned across and placed a fat white pillow behind his shoulders before releasing him back into its soft embrace. He smelled of the sun, as if it had seeped deep into his skin, and I found myself inhaling silently, as if he was something delicious. Then, still a little damp, I climbed in beside him, so close that my legs touched his, and together we gazed out at the blue-white scorch as the lightning hit the waves, at the silvered stair rods of rain, the gently shifting mass of turquoise that lay only 100 feet away. The world around us shrank, until it was just the sound of the storm, the gently billowing gauze curtains, my shallow breath. I smelled the lotus flowers on the night breeze, heard the distant sounds of clinking glasses and hastily drawn back chairs, of music from some far-off celebration, felt the charge of nature unleashed. I reached across for Will's hand and took it in my own. I thought, briefly, that I would never feel as intensely connected to the world, to another human being, as I did at that moment.
"Not bad, eh, Clark?" Will said into the silence.
In the face of the storm, his face was still and calm. He turned briefly and smiled at me, and there was something in his eyes then, something triumphant. "No," I said, "not bad at all." I lay still, listening to his breathing slow and deepen, the sound of the rain below it, felt his warm fingers entwined with mine. I didn't want to go home. I thought I might never go home. Here Will and I were safe, locked in our little paradise. Every time I thought about heading back to England, a great claw of fear gripped my stomach and began to tighten its hold. "It's going to be okay," I tried to repeat Nathan's words to myself. "It's going to be okay." Finally, I turned onto my side, away from the sea, and gazed at Will. He turned his head to look back at me in the dim light, and I felt he was telling me the same thing. "It's going to be okay." For the first time in my life, I tried not to think about the future. I tried to just be, to simply let the evening sensations travel through me. I can't say how long we stayed like that, just gazing at each other. But gradually Will's eyelids grew heavier, until he murmured apologetically that he thought he might. His breathing deepened. He tipped over that small crevasse into sleep. And then it was just me watching his face, looking at the way his eyelashes separated into little points near the corners of his eyes, at the new freckles on his nose. I told myself I had to be right. I had to be right. The storm finally blew itself out sometime after 1 a.m., disappearing somewhere out at sea, its flashes of anger growing fainter and then finally disappearing altogether, off to bring meteorological tyranny to some other unseen place. The air slowly grew still around us, the curtains settling, the last of the water draining away with a gurgle. Sometime in the early hours I got up, gently releasing my hand from Will's, and closed the French windows, muffling the room in silence. Will slept, a sound, peaceful sleep that he rarely slept at home. I didn't. I lay there, and watched him, and tried to make myself think nothing at all. Two things happened on the last day. One was that under pressure from Will, I agreed to try scuba diving. He'd been at me for days, stating that I couldn't possibly come all this way and not go under the water. I had been hopeless at windsurfing, barely able to lift my sail from the waves, and had spent most of my attempts at water skiing face-planting my way along the bay. But he was insistent, and the day before had arrived at lunch announcing that he had booked me in for a half-day beginner's diving course. It didn't get off to a good start. Will and Nathan sat on the side of the pool as my instructor tried to get me to believe I would continue to breathe underwater. But the knowledge that they were watching me made me hopeless. I'm not stupid. I understood that the tanks on my back would supply me with plenty of air, that my equipment was working, that I wasn't about to drown. But every time my head went under, I panicked and burst through the surface. It was as if my body refused to believe that it could still breathe underneath several thousand gallons of Mauritius's finest chlorinated. "I don't think I can do this," I said, as I emerged for the seventh time, spluttering. James, my diving instructor, glanced behind me at Will and Nathan. "I can't," I said crossly. "It's just not me." James turned his back on the two men, tapped me on the shoulder, and gestured toward the open water. "Some people actually find it easier out there," he said quietly.
"In the sea?"
"Some people are better thrown in at the deep end. Come on, let's go out on the boat."
3/4 of an hour later, I was gazing underwater at the brightly coloured landscape that had been hidden from view, forgetting to be afraid that my equipment might fail, that against all evidence I would sink to the bottom and die a watery death, even that I was afraid at all. I was distracted by the secrets of a new world. In the silence, broken only by the exaggerated whoosh-shoo of my own breath, I watched shoals of tiny iridescent fish and larger black-and-white fish that stared at me with blank, inquisitive faces, and gently swaying anemones filtering the gentle currents of their tiny, unseen hall. I saw distant landscapes twice as brightly coloured and varied as they were above land. I saw caves and hollows where unknown creatures lurked, distant shapes that shimmered in the rays of the sun. I didn't want to come up. I could have stayed there forever in that silent world. It was only when James started gesticulating toward the dial of his watch that I realized I didn't have a choice. I could barely speak when I finally walked up the beach toward Will and Nathan, beaming. My mind was still humming with the images I'd seen, my limbs somehow still propelling me under the water.
"Good, eh?" said Nathan.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
I exclaimed to Will, throwing my flippers down on the sand in front of him.
"Why didn't you make me do that earlier? All that. It was all there, all the time, just right under my nose."
Will gazed at me steadily. He said nothing at first, but his smile was slow and wide.
"I don't know, Clark. Some people just won't be told."
I let myself get drunk that last night. It wasn't just that we were leaving the next day. It was the first time I'd felt truly that Will was well, and that I could let go. I wore a white cotton dress. My skin had coloured now, so that wearing white didn't automatically make me resemble a corpse wearing a shroud, and a pair of silvery, strappy sandals. And when Nadil gave me a scarlet flower and instructed me to put it in my hair, I didn't scoff at him, as I might have done a week earlier.
"Well, hello, Carmen Miranda," Will said, when I met them at the bar. "Don't you look glamorous?"
I was about to make some sarcastic reply, and then I realized he was looking at me with genuine pleasure.
"Thank you," I said. "You're not looking too shabby yourself."
There was a disco at the main hotel complex, so shortly before 10 p.m, when Nathan left to be with Karen, we headed down to the beach with the music in our ears and the pleasant buzz of 3 cocktails sweetening my movements. Oh, but it was so beautiful down there. The night was warm, carrying on its breezes the scents of distant barbecues, of warm oils on skin, of the faint salt tang of the sea. Will and I stopped near our favourite tree. Someone had built a fire on the beach, perhaps for cooking, and all that was left was a pile of glowing embers. "I don't want to go home," I said into the darkness.
"It's a hard place to leave."
I didn't think places like this existed outside films, I said, turning so that I faced him. It's actually made me wonder if you might have been telling the truth about all the other stuff. He was smiling. His whole face seemed relaxed and happy, his eyes crinkling as he looked at me. I looked at him, and for the first time it wasn't with a faint fear gnawing away at my insides. You're glad you came, right? I said tentatively.
He nodded. Oh, yes.
Ha! I punched the air. And then, as someone turned the music up by the bar, I kicked off my shoes and I began to dance. It sounds stupid. The kind of behavior that on another day you might be embarrassed by. But there, in the inky dark, half drunk from lack of sleep, with the fire and the endless sea and infinite sky, with the sounds of the music in our ears, and Will smiling, and my heart bursting with something I couldn't quite identify, I just needed to dance. I danced, laughing, not self-conscious, not worrying about whether anybody could see us. I felt Will's eyes on me, and I knew he knew that this was the only possible response to the last 10 days. Hell, to the last 6 months. The song ended, and I flopped breathless at his feet.
You, he said.
What?
My smile was mischievous.
I felt fluid, electrified. I barely felt responsible for myself. He shook his head. I rose slowly onto my bare feet, walked right up to his chair, and then slid onto his lap so that my face was inches from his. After the previous evening, it somehow didn't seem like such a leap to make.
You.
His blue eyes, glinting with the light of the fire, locked onto mine. He smelled of the sun and the bonfire, and something sharp and citrusy. I felt something give, deep inside me.
You are something else, Clark.
I did the only thing I could think of. I leaned forward, and I placed my lips on his. He hesitated just for a moment, and then he kissed me. And just for a moment, I forgot everything. The million and one reasons I shouldn't, my fears, the reason we were here. I kissed him, breathing in the scent of his skin, feeling his soft hair under my fingertips. And when he kissed me back, all of this vanished, and it was just Will and me, on an island in the middle of nowhere, under 1,000 twinkling stars. And then he pulled back.
I'm sorry. No.
My eyes opened. I lifted my hand to his face and let it trace his beautiful bones. I felt the faint grit of salt under my fingertips. Will, I began. You can. You...
No.
It held a hint of metal, that word.
I can't.
I don't understand.
I don't want to go into it.
I think you have to go into it.
I can't do this because I can't...
He swallowed.
I can't be the man I want to be with you. And that means that this...
He looked up into my face.
This just becomes another reminder of what I'm not.
I didn't let go of his face. I tipped my forehead forward so that it touched his, so that our breath mingled. And I said, quietly, so that only he could have heard me, I don't care what you think you can and can't do. It's not black and white. Honestly, I've talked to other people in the same situation and there are things that are possible. Ways that we can both be happy. I'd begun to stammer a little. I looked up and into his eyes. Will Traynor, I said softly. Here's the thing. I think we can do...
No, Clark, he began.
I think we can do all sorts of things. I know this isn't a conventional love story. I know there are all sorts of reasons I shouldn't even be saying what I am. But I love you. I do. I knew it when I left Patrick. And I think you might even love me a little bit. He didn't speak. His eyes searched my own, and there was this huge weight of sadness within them. I stroked the hair away from his temples, as if I could somehow lift his sorrow, and he tilted his head to meet the palm of my hand so that it rested there. He swallowed.
I have to tell you something.
I know, I whispered. I know everything. Will's mouth closed on his words. The air seemed to still around us. I know about Switzerland. I know why I was employed on a 6-month contract. He lifted his head away from my hand. He looked at me, then gazed upward at the skies. His shoulders sagged. I know it all, Will. I've known for months. And Will, please listen to me. I took his right hand in mine, and I brought it up close to my chest. I know we can do this. I know it's not how you would have chosen it, but I know I can make you happy. And all I can say is that you make me... You make me into someone I couldn't even imagine. You make me happy, even when you're awful. I would rather be with you, even the you that you seem to think is diminished, than with anyone else in the world. I felt his fingers tighten a fraction around mine, and it gave me courage. If you think it's too weird with me being employed by you, then I'll leave and I'll work somewhere else. I wanted to tell you, I've applied for a college course. I've done loads of research on the internet, talking to other quads and caregivers of quads, and I've learned so much about how to make this work. So I can do that and just be with you. You see, I've thought of everything, researched everything. This is how I am now. This is your fault. You changed me. I was half laughing. You've turned me into my sister, but with better dress sense. He had closed his eyes. I placed both my hands around his, lifted his knuckles to my mouth, and I kissed them. I felt his skin against mine, and knew as I'd never known anything that I couldn't let him go. What do you say? I whispered. I could have looked into his eyes forever. He said it so quietly that for a minute I couldn't be sure I'd heard him correctly. What? No, Clark. No.
I'm sorry. It's not enough. I lowered his hand.
I don't understand. He waited before he spoke, as if he were struggling, for once, to find the right words.
It's not enough for me. This, my world, even with you in it. And believe me, Clark, my whole life has changed for the better since you came. But it's not enough for me.
It's not the life I want. Now it was my turn to pull away.